Let's go.
The most energetic, fit, and stress-resilient people on the planet practice daily habits to keep their hormones balanced, their gut healthy, and their muscles and mind strong. Welcome to That Fitness Couple. We're Mike and Corey Beth Lepowski, founders of Pure Physique.
This podcast is designed to provide you with everything we've discovered and continue to discover about nutrition, training, and lifestyle. Today, we all live hectic lives.
So we've made it our mission to make your fitness time efficient and to build you up. Hope you share and enjoy. Let's dive into today's episode.
Let's go.
On today's show, we have two very special guests with us, Liam Bauer and Jesse Schmidt, the hosts of TNT Podcast and owners of TNT Strength Studio in Oakland, California. And while we think these two gentlemen are absolutely dynamite, the TNT stands for Truth, Not Trends, and we'll be getting into a little bit of that today. In addition to being a couple of swell guys, they're two of our favorite people in the fitness industry, and they are always up to speed with the latest in evidence-based exercise and nutrition. We've had some amazing conversations as guests on their podcast, as well as at events that we all attended together, and we're excited to finally have them on as guests on That Fitness Couple. Welcome, Liam and Jesse.
Booyah.
Yeah.
The only thing I take issue with in that intro, Mike, is it's two swole guys. We're not just swell. We're also swole.
They are West Coast, you know?
Yeah. Not as swole as Mike.
Well, he's talking about swell as in the ocean swell. He's talking about swole. Anyway.
I do like the ocean swell as well.
I know you do. It's awesome to have you guys. And I think you guys know how we do things around here. We always like to kick it off with a little bit of true and false just to set the tone for the conversation going forward. I'm sure we're going to go down many paths today, but let's just start with this. I'm going to take number one here. So Jesse, this one is for you. True or false, or you can add a caveat if necessary. You are a ninja.
I am a ninja. I guess it's true. I have not been officially on the American Ninja Warrior show, but I've been a course tester at Universal Studios a few times, and I'm an avid Spartan racer and obstacle course racer. So sure. Yeah, we'll go with yeah.
Well, number two goes to you, Liam, and that is, if Jesse is a ninja, then you are the Bruce Lee of fitness.
Wow. I don't know if that's true, but I'll take it. I like it.
I mean, I think you have to take it because it's in your bio.
Yeah. I think what they mean by that is, you know, the idea that I like Bruce Lee, you know, in my evolution, I explore everything and only keep what's valuable and get rid of everything else.
Awesome. And that's also why I know
learns things from lots of different.
That is true as well.
Disciplines.
And separately, I do have a very long running background in martial arts. But that's like a whole separate thing.
Liam, I got another one for you. True or false? You've been a strength coach since 1988. That's 35 years.
That is true. And coming up quick on 36.
Well, Jesse, this one goes to you. You and I were both in diapers when Liam started training.
That's a fact. Yeah, that's we make a lot of old guy jokes around here with Liam.
Yes,
people. It's funny that people don't they won't accept that he is 62 years old. They a lot of the time think he's about 20 years younger than he is, which is pretty cool.
Pretty awesome. Well, since we're talking about old guys, Liam, people who are 55 plus should train differently than those who are in their 20s and 30s.
Is that a true or false?
That's a true or false.
Oh, I say false.
I like it.
Back to you, Jesse. There's a certain amount of dietary sugar needed each day for energy.
That's false. There's 0 grams of carbohydrate are required to sustain human life. When we're coaching our clients here, we basically tell everybody to eat a high protein diet and they do what they want to do with carbohydrates and fats. And some people do better with higher or lower carbs. Some people do better with higher or lower fat. But everybody needs lots of protein and nobody needs lots of sugar, really.
Absolutely. Well, I think we're going to go a little bit deeper on that one. In fact, we had an awesome conversation with you guys when we were on your podcast around sugar. I wish I could remember it all because it would have been awesome to integrate here. But moving on, we'll get through our questions and we'll circle back. Liam, there is a limit on how much meat a person should eat.
I say false personally. I'm sure people would take umbrage with that, but eat it until you don't want it anymore. there is a satiety mechanism, you know, in place. So you don't really need to worry about it. And that is not the case with carbohydrates, which is a whole nother conversation. So yes, eat the protein until you are satisfied.
I love that. Final true or false here, Jesse, goes to you. And that is, training to momentary muscular failure is overrated.
That's definitely false. Highly underrated. There are a million different rabbit holes we could go down on that one. But definitely train hard, train to failure. Make sure you're resting as much as you can, or at least for probably a couple of days in between workouts, and then do it again.
All right. Use me. All right, guys. Well, with that,
he's got the meat sweats over here.
Yeah. I've never personally had meat sweats, but I'm looking forward to it.
Dude, I used to get the meat sweats when I was bodybuilding and going super high protein and very, very low fat. I don't know exactly what the mechanism is there that causes that, but that had been the only time in my life where I actually would get quote unquote meat sweats, but I couldn't even put all the blame on meat. Because at that time, I mean, the only meat that I was actually eating was like chicken and protein powders and the likes of that.
You're probably sweating because your body's like, I need more.
The thermogenesis is just so intense.
What are you doing to me?
Well, speaking of that, I was also taking liver tablets at that time. And I'd wake up in the middle of the night, not just sweating profusely, but like my calves would be cramping up like crazy. Nothing I've ever experienced before and never want to again.
You weren't taking any sort of electrolyte supplement or anything?
I knew nothing about that sort of thing back then.
Yeah. Middle of the night. I don't know what happens, but it seems like when people get cramps, a lot of the time it is in the middle of the night.
Well, let's go back to the beginning and let's talk a little bit about this ninjiness and I think even Liam, the concept of Bruce Lee. But Jesse, let's start with you. Can you give us a little bit of your background? I mean, you guys are these amazing personal trainers and so much more than that. But how did you get into all this world of ninja warrior?
I started, let's see, going way back. I don't know. I guess this was probably like 9 years ago or something like that. I was watching American Ninja Warrior and I thought it looked fun. I thought I could do it. So I noticed that the ninjas that did the best were also rock climbers. So I started rock climbing, indoor rock climbing first. And then I found out that there was a Ninja Warrior gym, you know, about 20 or 30 minutes away from my house. And so I started going there a couple times a week in addition to the rock climbing. I was still strength training. So I'm doing that stuff. And then I met Liam and somewhere in there, I learned a little bit about high intensity training and I changed the way I train. So I was now, you know, doing like a hard ninja workout once a week and, you know, lifting and rock climbing on another day. And yeah, I went and I was a course tester at Universal Studios. That was good. I was like within a hair of being on the show, I think, because I got a call from producers 1 year, but they decided they didn't want me, I guess. And so that was that. I've done a lot of gym competitions and had fun with it. And my main thing now is Spartan races. I do a handful of Spartan races every year, which are obstacle course races where you run a quarter of a mile and then you jump over a wall and then you run some more and then you lift a heavy boulder or, you know, it's a lot of lifting heavy things and running. Speaking of cramping, I cramped up in a race for the first time ever because I was running the most recent race. It was in 90 degree heat and it was a 15 mile race. I was good until the sun came out because I started early and about mile 10, my quads cramped up, which has never happened to me in my life. It was crazy, but I should have brought some extra electrolyte powder with me because I was cramping up. And but I finished the race and I actually still finished like in the top 10% of finishers. So had a good time. But yeah, that's my main thing now is just, you know, our normal high intensity training. And I run a 10K once a week and run a Spartan race every few months.
Do you have Liam train you? Like when you guys are training in studio, you guys train each other?
Oh, yeah.
So what does that look like for you? Like what is your workout program? Since you are doing all this other activity, where does the resistance training fit in? And, you know, for our audience, they don't know this, but, you know, you guys and us, we train very similar, if not the same. And I would love for you to just give your perspective on how your training fits into being someone who is partaking in these, you know, competitive athletic events.
Yeah, I mean, we at TNT in our business, we recommend that people train two times per week with a couple days of rest in between. Typically, it's a full body workout. And we train the same way as we recommend that our clients train. Right now, I don't know, I've been on a weird program, so I'm training once a week right now. On Fridays, I run a 10K. On Tuesdays, I do a full body workout. I don't know, I probably do between 8 and 12 exercises, one single set to momentary muscular failure. What I like to do ideally is, if I can, is preset all of the exercises. So, you know, load up all the weights that I'm going to use and then try to eliminate the rest in between exercises, which is kind of the classic Nautilus HIIT style. And so a lot of the time I'm finishing my workout in, you know, 12 to 15 minutes. So that's really like, for the last couple of weeks, I don't know if it'll stay this way, but for the last couple of weeks, I've basically been doing, you know, let's say a maximum of like 15 or 20 minutes of resistance training a week and then running a 10K. And that's the only, you know, that's the only intense exercise I'm doing for the week. The rest of it is just, I try to, you know, walk, I don't know, 10,000 steps a day if I can, but it's not a super big focus for me. It's more just make sure I'm getting my lift in, getting my run in, and eating my body weight in grams of protein every day.
Liam, are you tracking what he's doing in these workouts?
Yes. Yeah. So I've been, I create the workouts usually ahead of time. I mean, the reality is we have a whole software system and I pre-create a huge menu of workouts. So like probably most of the workouts in there were created by me, and there's like hundreds, I don't know how many are in there. But I set the workouts up ahead of time, and our schedule is such at the moment that at the time that and days that we're set up to work out to do Jesse's strength training, there's nobody else in the gym. So as he said, we can preset the machines. I have everything tracked meticulously like we do with our clients. So I already know what his best efforts are on each exercise. And then I'm selecting the order. These days, unless he wants something special, like, you know, I'll let him request, you know, if he wants to focus on a certain thing. Like some days he goes, hey, I really want to hit my arms or whatever. So like I'll build a routine that sort of emphasizes that, but they're always full body routines. We do neck stuff, we do low back stuff, we do ab stuff, a little bit of everything. We'll change the order, the sequence, sometimes rep cadences, right? All those little things that you guys are very familiar with. But the basic structure stays the same. Lately, I'd say we've been averaging 10 sets per workout. And again, just varying, they're very hard. Jesse's a super hard worker. He takes very little rest between sets. He always gives it his best effort. And we just, I mean, the only time he takes to rest is the time it takes him to walk to the next machine. And there's nobody in the way, right? We're not a commercial gym. There's no chance of interference. So as we say, the workouts are super brief. And it's worth noting, like, even over the years, like when we were working commercial gyms and stuff, this has been going on for a while now. I mean, imagine for the listeners, right? He runs one 10K run a week, right? That's it. One time a week, he runs 10K at a good pace, right? Where he challenges him, he tries to push himself. He's lifting one time a week on average, and he's placing in the top percentage of these races, right? And this has been true of Jesse for a long time. Like, I remember they did this stair climb thing, these buildings, right? Like, you know, where you have to climb as fast as you can, you know, 30 floors or 50 floors or whatever.
48 floors.
So 48 floors. Again, he was strength training very minimally, zero cardio, quote unquote, right? And he's like coming in the top, right? And you know, there's these people that spend months like preparing, like, I got to get ready for the stair climb. And they probably build these elaborate programs for themselves, right? Meanwhile, he's strength training once a week and doing zero cardio, and he still comes in the top like five people or whatever. And this is happening all the time. People overtrain in every sport, right? Now, keep in mind, he's not winning these races, right? But he is like in these
yes.
top. Yeah, yeah. Yes. But he's in these top percentages training what most people would think is highly inadequate, right? So with a little more focus, there's no doubt that he could like push up to the edge, right? And he's, you know, this would seem like nothing to the average person who thinks they need to be in the gym, you know, six times a week or whatever. And they got to run and they got to stretch and they got to do their pre thing and they got to do their post thing and they got a dynamic warm up and foam roll for half an hour. They would literally be working out like 3 hours a day if you follow those plans.
Well, and I think it speaks a lot though to how effective doing the training properly can be for the average individual, right? And sorry, Jesse, I don't mean to put you in the bucket of being average, but the fact that though, you know, you're no genetic marvel. I mean, none of us here are, right? Like none of us here are a genetic marvel. And yet everybody here has been able to achieve a pretty significant level of health, of fitness with extremely minimal time commitment when all things are considered. And so I just love the fact that, again, practice what you preach, right? You're competing at the highest level and you're performing really well. And yet here you are putting forth what, maybe an hour total of exercise per week?
Yeah, and not only that, but it's probably an hour and a half because running the 10K takes 50 to 60 minutes. Sometimes it's a little farther than that. But the other thing is I've never hurt, you know, and that's the other thing about, you know, whether you're an athlete or you're, you know, whatever you're training for something is it's literally just not a concern for me. I can go out and do like a hard ninja workout, or I can run a Spartan race, or I can like when I go on a hike with my girlfriend or with friends or whatever, I don't think about the difficulty of the hike because it's just I'm just like when you train in a high intensity style, when you're resting sufficiently between workouts, you're just ready to go, you know. And if you want to, you know, amp up the nutrition and get on stage for a bodybuilding show or something like that, then, you know, you make some tweaks. If you want to, you know, ramp up your muscle as high as you can get it and eat some more calories and additional protein, maybe a slightly higher volume in your workouts. But that's what I love about training in this style is it doesn't take a lot of time. I feel my body feels good all the time. I'm not hurt. That was the big thing when I first started with the rock climbing and ninja stuff and I met Liam. That all happened around the same time. And I was injured. I had these nagging injuries like any, you know, athlete or runner does. I was wearing one of those like elbow sleeves because I had, you know, probably what was like elbow tendonitis or something like that. And it was just from overuse because I was lifting four times a week and doing ninja stuff a couple times a week and rock climbing a couple times a week. And it was just way too much intense activity. So I dropped the frequency of that activity down and I brought up the intensity and the injuries went away and they've never come back. So to me, that's just glaringly obvious evidence that this style of training is superior to what I was doing before.
Well, I think for Jesse, and I'm going to speak for myself too, like, thank God we found you guys to totally transform the way that we train. What I want to know for Liam is, has your philosophy of training changed or been altered over the last almost four decades, which I just want to say is so impressive. And also too, let me just throw this in. When I met you, I had no idea you were in your 60s. You are one of the healthiest. You got great skin, great shape, great muscle tone. I mean, there's so many things about you. I'm like, what? There is no way. But the question is, has your philosophy of training changed over this time?
I mean, if you want to go all the way back to the beginning, I don't know how far back you want me to go.
It's a long way back.
Yeah, it is. Let me see if I can get back there. When I first started, like most people, when I was introduced to strength training, I knew nothing about it. I started reading the muscle magazines. I did all the things that so many people do. I was training way too much. I think I was training like in the very beginning, I think I was doing calisthenics in the morning and the evening and lifting in the afternoon. So I was working like three times a day, basically 6 days a week. I went through the Arnold stuff where I trained 3 hours a day, 6 days a week in the beginning, kind of like Jesse. I was always injured. My gym bag was full of like wraps and, you know, like something for my elbow or my wrist. I always had to wrap something up. I never thought about taking a day off or that, you know, maybe something needed to rest, right? Just work through it. And I was not bigger and stronger, you know what I mean, comparatively. Ironically, my very, very first job in a gym, and luckily, was with a gym that was owned by Nautilus. And I was introduced to the Nautilus principles immediately upon my very first job in the fitness industry. But I didn't believe it at the time, right? Because I was reading the magazines and I kept thinking, well, the magazines don't tell me that, right? That's not what, you know, whoever the star of the day was, Gary Stridham, I think, maybe somebody like that. If anybody can remember those names way back, Rich Gaspari, right? But I was like, that's not what those guys do, right? And here I saw what was interesting was before my eyes, the guys that looked the best that were doing it, they all were following these Nautilus principles. And I would say, hey, this guy looks incredible. I go, hey, how often do you work out? I don't know, like, you know, a couple times a week. I was like, what? It's like, it can't be possible, right? You know, and I had to have my own epiphanies, you know, along the way. And part of it was I used to, quote unquote, do the advanced training, right? The bodybuilders, like the advanced stuff. And so my very first epiphany was because I would get hit the wall, I'd overtrain, I'd get sick, I'd get hurt, whatever. I had this, you know, one moment where I just thought, what if I stayed on the beginner plan, you know, and just train my whole body three times a week? Because that was what Nautilus used to say, right? What I found then, though, was as I started to embrace those things, that I quickly found that for me, my whole body three times a week training to failure was too much. I would overtrain. And what I started doing way back then was I would do it, but I would take 1 week off a month. And that works because I would train as hard as I could. And after about 3 weeks, it was too much. So I trained to failure three times a week and then take the last week of the month off. Right. And so it would build up, kind of take that break. And that worked also. But, you know, I didn't think of not training three times a week, right? I just thought, because that was, you know, everybody's preaching it, Darden, Jones. And then I started realizing, like, the mistakes, in my opinion, that Ellington Darden made back in the day when he would always compare, like, the split training versus the, he'd say, well, we do three times a week whole body, but if it's a split, you go 6 days a week, right? Mm-hmm. And I started to think, why don't you do a split three times a week, right? And do the whole body. The whole body actually only gets hit once, but Darden never did that back in his old days, right? And so I said, try comparing that. It would probably be just as good or better, right? But anyway, yeah, the short answer, because I'm not good at short answers, is that, yes, it's evolved tremendously. And I pulled influences going back to that Bruce Lee thing from all kinds of coaches. I mean, not to speak of blasphemy, but, you know, things from CrossFit, things from other guys who I admire, like JC Santana. I don't know if you guys are familiar with him, out of IHP in Florida. He has a place called the Institute of Human Performance. He's one of the best coaches in the world, as far as I'm concerned. Definitely not a hit guy. Incredible, brilliant, prolific, very successful. He trains lots of very high-end athletes. He's had a huge influence on my training philosophy. I've been lucky enough to meet all kinds of incredible coaches, some from the high intensity, some from others, and then pull those things, you know, Pete Sisko, from, you know, power factor training and doing static contraction stuff. Lots of guys have influenced me, and I've been able to draw those things and, you know, take that information and, you know, A and C and extrapolate to B instead of just being stuck where other people get trapped. Even in the high intensity niche, as I'm sure you guys know, and Mike certainly wouldn't know, they get really dogmatic. And, you know, and this is true in the martial arts world too. So there's another parallel. You know, the martial arts world is real common. Like, you get into Bruce Lee stuff and it's like, well, if you're not doing it the way he did it in the 60s, you know, and his whole thing was evolve, right? So he would say, no, you don't get stuck where I was. You keep on going, right? And same thing, like some people are like, well, if you're not doing it Arthur Jones way, right, you're not really true to the high intensity training, right? And we all know that you have to evolve. And even Darden eventually evolved and recognized, hey, maybe 2 days a week is enough for some people. And even Jones figured that out eventually. So yeah, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, yes. I do evolve and pull from life.
There's a couple things, two things in particular that I wanted to just extrapolate from, you know, things that both of you just said, because I also, when I started my journey into high intensity training, I was riddled with injuries. It was the rotator cuff from bench pressing every Monday, right? You know, since 13 years old till 22 years old, every Monday is
international chest day.
International chest day. You're absolutely right. And so the first exercise you have to do is a bench press, and you got to do at least 4 to 5 sets of them. So I had all of the rotator cuff injuries, then irritation in the elbow and tendonitis, low back, neck. I mean, you named it, I had an issue. And one of the first things that I realized was by cutting back my frequency of training, not training every single day, and allowing my body more time to recover. I mean, that was one of the first things that I noticed. The back pain going away. The shoulder's no longer an issue. Elbow, never even knew there was a problem. In fact, today, I mean, at 46, I forget all the injuries that I had at 26. It's insane to think that making that shift. And for a lot of people, you know, the struggle, and I'm sure you guys could probably speak to this too. And I know Corey Beth Ken as well, even though she was a cardio queen, she was in the gym frequently. And there is that mental shift that you have to make, that everything's not going to fall apart because I'm not in the gym 5-6 days a week, because I'm not putting in the requisite 60 to 90 minutes in each workout. So, I mean, what was like that shift for you guys? Because I know for me, it was challenging and I was very slow to finally embrace high intensity training.
Yeah. Well, just to latch onto that idea for a second, Mike, I mean, I think it's always going to be challenging for people to overcome the kind of like commonly accepted social practices. And you have, like, to use a couple examples right now, you have a couple people in the zeitgeist like David Goggins or Alex Hormozi, who are like actively talking about how overtraining doesn't exist, right? These are people who are like gods in the social media fitness universe right now. And they're literally like, if you read David Goggins' books, so you listen to him talk, he's like, I don't care about overtraining. I don't believe in it. I understand the science. I just ignore it. And so, you know, if you understand David Goggins, you know, he's willing to just completely wreck his body. He's done some amazing things.
More stupid,
but he, both. But he does. That's the thing. He doesn't care. He treats his body as if it's like completely bulletproof. He's been able to, you know, just do some amazing things. But yeah, he's riddled with injuries as many people are. So for me, I mean, I think it just comes down to like, what are your goals? Like, do you want to put your body to the, you know, to the limit, no matter what the cost, or do you want to, you know, live and be, you know, like, achieve your genetic potential for strength and like not have injuries? Because that's what I feel like I do on a regular basis. You know, maybe there's a little bit more I could like eke out, you know, if I increase the volume, you know, a little bit, and like maybe if Liam was like screaming a little bit louder in my ear while we're training. But, you know, I feel like I'm consistently like at my best and I'm unhurt and I can do the things that I like to do. And I can push my limits when I want to. So I don't know. That for me is fulfilling my goals. And I won't speak for Liam.
Yeah, I mean, maybe this is a similar, or at least pieces of it are similar for you, Mike. But, you know, I got like a lot of guys, once I got into it, and I immediately like wanted to be huge, right? I wanted to be as big as I could. And for me personally, I got to the point where I actually thought, well, I got to get on the juice, right? Like, I'm not a big guy. I don't have the genes, right? Like, what can I do? And years ago, I'm not talking like 30 years ago or something, I literally sat down in a guy's apartment. All the drugs were right there on the table. I had the money in my pocket. He was telling me how to inject properly and when to do this and how to use that. He was a successful bodybuilder himself, you know, had competed in the high levels of the MPC, won a bunch of stuff, looked great, you know. And at the time, I literally just changed my mind in that moment, like, why am I doing this? You know, like what? But it wasn't for health reasons. I did a lot of research. I wasn't afraid of it, like hurting me or anything. I was going to, you know, I wasn't going to just stick a bunch of stuff. I was, you know, talking to doctors, blood work. I try to do things intelligently. I don't just think steroids make you die or give you diseases. They're like anything that can be used or misused or abused or used intelligently. But I just decided, like, is it, you know, why do I want to do this? And is it that important to me? And my goals have shifted. You know, I used to want to be huge, and, you know, and I did, you know, I weighed 128 pounds. If people can imagine when I started lifting, I was 26 years old. So I was a grown man in college. I'd never worked out. I was a soccer player. All I did was run miles and miles and miles. I didn't do any lifting.
He got locked up one night, but he slipped out because he could just squeeze between the bars.
Yeah. I mean, I used to, like, people didn't know what happened to me when I was in the shower because I kept slipping down the drain. But, when I started lifting, I put on weight quickly, like young people often do. I ate a lot. I worked hard, and I did put on 30 pounds, 40 pounds over several years. And I made it up to like 160. Which was huge, right? Coming, you know, like 30 pounds, and I looked bigger and stronger and all those things that come along with it. And I was also learning how to do things effectively. But these days, you know, obviously my goals have changed. And over the years, I've decided, you know, what I'm constantly searching for is what is the least amount I can do to still make me feel as good as possible. And, you know, I walk around now walking down the street, and I consciously, it dawns on me, like, I feel pretty good. You know, I'm like moving through the world. I'm not slow. I'm not struggling. I don't feel sore or achy, or, you know, I don't have trouble getting in and out of chairs, or, you know what I mean?
He's a little persnickety, though, yeah, if you ask me.
That's true. I do have those moments.
I mean, that's expected. That's to be expected.
He yells at the cars in the neighborhood. They're driving too fast.
This isn't music.
Hold on. I want to go back a second, though, to something you said, Jesse, about David Goggins, right? And some of our audience may be very well versed with who he is. He is all over the internet. I mean, if you own the internet, you should probably know who he is. He's the guy who does nothing but scream and curse at the camera and tell you that, you know, you should run until your legs fall off. Here's the thing, though, that I find really interesting. I just happened to be reading Doug McGuff's second book on Body by Science, the one that was more of the Q&A version. Mm-hmm. And in there, they were talking about, why is it today we're seeing all the old-time bodybuilders dying or in really poor health? And these were people, both men and women, who were at the pinnacle of what we would view as being healthy and fit. And we now know that with, you know, the drug abuse, not necessarily the use, but the abuse, but also the way that they went about their training. And this is what he talked about, how when we are overtraining, mentally, you might be able to push through it like a David Goggins. and just say, oh, screw it. You know, this is all a mental test. And you can push through, but it doesn't take away from the fact that you are building up an extensive amount of oxidative stress in your body, which is first going to show up as little injuries, as well as the aches and pains that just don't seem to go away. But then later on, it really rears its head where now you're incapacitated. And for all of the training that you did, and this also touches to your point about goals, right? For all the training you did, what did it get you? Like, yeah, you were able to go online and scream and yell about how far you can take your body, but now you're broken. And then to tie into this too, because I think oxidative stress might be a good rabbit hole for us to go down. There's the nutrition piece. We talked earlier in our Q&A about sugar and do we actually need sugar? So you guys want to bat this one around a little bit. I mean, I would love to talk about oxidative stress on the body via nutrition as well as exercise.
Yeah, I mean, one of the guys I mentioned previously, Pete Sisko, who was, you know, a friend and mentor of mine over the years, he recently retired. So he's like literally pulled every single thing that was fitness related off the internet and decided to disappear. Unfortunately, he's doing some other stuff with his life. But, you know, one thing that he said, which I always liked, was every day is kidney day. And what he meant by that is like your body doesn't get to take a day off, right? You're dealing with the byproducts of the stress, byproducts of fatigue on any given day. Like when people think, oh, I'm training chest today and back tomorrow or whatever, right? Well, you're dealing with the stress of yesterday, today, no matter what, right? There's systemic fatigue versus localized fatigue. And this is outside of just the pure oxidative stress, right? So I always tell people there's one pool of resources, right? You don't have a separate pool. That's relationship stress comes off of that pool, and you know, your job stress, right? There's that one pool and it's all coming off of there, right? We don't just have exercise stress, which causes a positive adaptation, hopefully, but it's still a stress, right? And we can't control every stress in our life necessarily. And they're all draining off that one pool of resources that we have. And if we're not balancing all that stuff correctly, and as I guess we're going to talk about, you know, taking in the right fuels and stuff to, you know, minimize and replenish, you know, you're setting yourself up for some trouble.
Yeah, I think that they're probably like Doug McGuff would be a great person. I can't remember. Maybe he even talks about, you know, the byproducts of, you know, strength training or just exercise in general in terms of, you know, like certain hormonal changes happen when we exercise. You're talking about oxidative stress, like mTOR, like a little bit of mTOR is good, but a lot of mTOR is, you know, not as good, you know, so when you do extrapolate that over, you know, months and years and decades of your life, some of those things can, you know, basically you can even have too much of a good thing, right? With exercise, some moderation is probably a good thing. As far as the, I read the example from my life of that. I mean, I already talked about the like ninja stuff, but I also play other sports. I grew up playing baseball. I like playing basketball, and, I'm a person who's always sort of had like used sports as an escape. So I think of myself as having a much more like healthy balance of things right now, because in the past, I might do something like go to 24-hour fitness and play like 3 to 4 hours of pickup basketball, which was fun because like the way it works is like you play a game and if you win, you stay on the court and so a new team comes on. And sometimes you roll with the team who just can't stop winning. So, you know, my body will be telling me one thing, but I'm, you know, hooked on the game. So, you know, 4 hours later, I limp off the court, having had a great time, but not able to walk for the rest of the day, you know, so those things aren't good. I probably could have played for 2 hours and been pretty tired, but been able to, you know, stand up off the couch. But getting to the nutrition, I really think like people just aren't thinking rationally or honestly with themselves a lot of the time when it comes to nutrition. People like sugar. Sugar is delicious and they don't want to give it up. I don't think it's any more complex than that. People know at a base level, like they don't need to eat muffins. You know, they don't need tons of sugar, but we like eating those things. They're delicious and they're easily accessible. So it's easy to eat a lot of them. I'm around a lot more runners these days than I have been in the past. And man, these people are all about the glucose gels and tablets and stuff, especially during a race. I'm like, I ran a 15-mile race and I didn't eat anything. I should have had more electrolytes, but I didn't have any goos. I didn't have anything like that. And I was totally fine.
What made you capable of doing that, though? You know, somebody's hearing that and like, well, what makes Jesse different? Is he just special? Like, what is it about your nutrition that allowed for that?
Yeah, I just think people like way overthink this stuff. I don't change my nutrition for a race at all. Like, I might think about the amount of calories that I ingest immediately before the race because I don't want to feel like over full and feel heavy when I'm running. And I also don't want to be like, you know, hungry while I'm running. Fact is, if I run 15 miles, I'm now putting myself in about a 1500 calorie deficit. So I did go to In-N-Out and have myself a 6x6 after that race because I was hungry
now you're
afterwards.
Talking.
But during the race, I'm locked in. I'm totally fine. But I mean, like,
they may not have the benefit of knowing what a 6x6 is.
A 6x6 is six patties and six slices of cheese. So I probably ate about, you know, a pound and a half of meat.
With no buns or nothing. We're talking just meat.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have a burger joint around here called In-N-Out Burger. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that.
It's a big like West Coast chain.
Yeah. And they have a secret menu and there's all these things you can order, and you can order what they call protein style. And, you know, there's no buns. It's just meat. And there's all these different versions of it that you can order. That's basically just meat and cheese and how many of each you get. But yeah, and you can get unlimited. You can literally order as big of one as you want and they will make it for you. So
100 by 100.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
I would be totally game for that. We have five guys out here.
Yeah.
And at five guys, you know, the times that we have gone there, that's exactly what we did. It was ordering the patties, right? Double patties with cheese and bacon and no bun.
Yeah, there you go. So yeah, I mean, my nutrition on a daily, I'm kind of a robot. Like, I don't get bored eating the same things over and over because I love the things that I eat. So I eat about like almost every day for breakfast. I have two like stock breakfasts I go to. One is Greek yogurt with a little bit of fruit and cinnamon and honey in it. So I am getting some carbs, but it's not because like, it's just because I like it. It's not for any like health reason, really. I just like putting some cherries in my Greek yogurt. But I get almost 50 grams of protein from my breakfast. And then lunch tends to be, because I'm like doing a lean thing these days, tends to be like egg whites, a little bacon, and some, like, I don't know, chicken or sausage or steak or something mixed in there, like kind of like an egg white stir fry, maybe some veggies in there if my girlfriend forces me to. But
you might have to talk about your relationship if she's forcing you to have vegetables. I'm just saying that wouldn't go over well in this household.
My ex was a vegetarian. That didn't go down too well because my diet's like 90% meat. So
that's why she's your ex.
Exactly. Yeah. So now my girlfriend likes eating a lot of meat, but she does try to pepper in some vegetables here and there. So anyway, my diet is high protein. It's not low fat. It's not low. I would say it's, you know, probably my daily calories are probably like 60% protein consistently and maybe like 20 to 30% fat, 10 to 20% carbohydrates. And so when I go run a race, I don't know, my nutrition doesn't change. I feel I have great energy. I was going to say on the injury front, in this most recent race, sometimes you get to these like bottleneck spots in the race where there's like a compact trail and there'll be bushes on each side. And I'm going fast enough that like, I don't want to wait for like, you know, 5 minutes while these people take these little baby steps down the mountain. So I run through the bushes, like, and sometimes I can't see my steps. I feel confident enough. I mean, I'm going like stupid fast. Like, I might hurt myself just because I'm going so fast and I don't see where I'm stepping. But yeah, I haven't hurt myself yet. Knock on wood.
I don't know where we're going, but I you know, about sugar, I want to just jump on sugar really quick because I feel like ahead of the curve. I don't know if I really am, but I mean, I've been telling people for probably more than 30 years that there's no requirement for sugar in the human diet. And everybody thinks that's crazy. And I've been experimenting with
because they like eating sugar,
the low carb stuff and the keto stuff for more than 30 years. I've played with all those ideas and talked about it and written about it and experimented with it. I like to use myself always as a guinea pig on anything that I am going to recommend to my clients. I want them already done it on myself, so that I literally know what to expect. I think of my body as pretty normal and average. So I feel like I can use it as an example. And that comes in handy when I'm talking to nutrition or training or whatever. I literally know exactly what they're feeling or what they might feel or what to expect based on my own experience. Now, obviously, everybody's going to be slightly varied, but we're all also a lot the same, right, in certain ways. But I've been telling people that for years. And, you know, they, of course, you get all these incredulous responses. And, you know, it's like, what do you mean there's, you know, no requirement for sugar? I mean, I learned that so long ago. The way I look at it is I think of sugar as poison. I honestly do. I mean, I'm talking about processed sugar now, right? We know sugar, like Jesse, you know, there's a sugar in a blueberry, right? Or an apple. I mean, I have an apple tree in my backyard, and I pull apples off of there and dip them in almond butter, and they're, pardon me, delicious. Yeah, I'm not afraid of sugar, but I try not to eat any processed sugar in my life. And we have these business networking meetings. I just came from one this morning. We have a pastry chef in our group. And every time we have a meeting, that she brings all these elaborate pastries, and people are like, "Woohoo, tiramisu!" And I'm like, "I'm not eating tiramisu at 7 a.m. in the morning for breakfast. Like, what the hell are you talking about?" You know? And I just try to think of sugar as
this hormonal roller coaster.
I think of sugar as poison. That's how I see it in my mind, how I engage with it. And it, you know, it's hard to get people to recognize that. The other side of this thing is no one will give up those things that are making them sick, right? We all know this. I've seen it 1,000 times in my career. Someone comes to me with fibromyalgia or, you know, other inflammatory responses going on in their body. And I go, you know, if you gave up bread and, you know, a couple things, you will probably be pain-free or feel so much better. And they can't give up. They choose the pain, right? Over giving up the bread. I've never been able to understand it, right? We're not judgy. We don't push things on people. But inside, it doesn't compute for me that people won't let go of those things.
Interesting, because Corey Beth brought up a point yesterday in an episode that we had recorded, which was, you know, when people are going through difficult challenges in their life, you know, big, big life events, it's always interesting that they will give up the thing that keeps them feeling good and vibrant, you know, their exercise program, the way that they're eating, and now make this shift over to inactivity and eating stuff, as you said, poison, because they think that that is going to, you know, that's what's needed for this period in time. Like, I don't need the exercise right now. I need to focus on this thing that I'm doing.
Or it's that I'm too busy and I'm too stressed, so I got to give up the exercise. And in lieu of the exercise, they will go down this pathway of eating easy things, you know, accessible things. And, you know, they end up 5 times worse than if they had just continued on with what was actually serving them. Hey, we hope you're enjoying our show and finding it valuable. If you could do us a quick favor, it would mean the world to us. Please take a moment to rate and review our podcast on your favorite platform. Your reviews help us reach more people and share our message. Plus, we'd love to hear your feedback. Thanks for being awesome and supporting us. Now, back to the show.
I was telling these guys about this book I just finished. I bet you guys would enjoy it. It's called The Big Leap. And it's by this author. His name's Gay Hendricks, and he talks about something called the upper limit problem. And so we're getting sort of away from the science of training and more into like people coaching. But, you know, essentially he contends that people have this sort of like artificial like upper limit for how happy they should be in their life. And I kind of agree, right? We have these self-defeating behaviors that we employ consciously or unconsciously. So like Liam's talking about this example of a person who's like in pain and somebody offers a solution that, you know, like has proven to be effective. And they're like, nope, you know, and there's that. What's that old? It's like Heraclitus is like, you know, before you cure a patient, make sure they're willing to give up the thing that's making them sick.
Exactly.
You know? So, you know, people just I think this is bordering on like philosophical, but I just think that people, for whatever reason, people are flawed human beings, and often they're just not willing to give up the thing that's making them miserable or unhealthy, or maybe they're not even miserable. Maybe they're all right, right? Maybe their things are just fine, but they're unwilling to give up the thing that could make them great, you know?
Yeah, two quick little things just pop in my head culturally, I guess. One is, you know, my roommate, partner, whatever, came home the other day, had a bad day, was very unhappy, and said, "I'm eating ice cream for dinner," right? And I was like, okay, right. You do what you got to do. But what was interesting is I mentioned that to a client, female client. And like I go, she had ice cream for dinner last night. And she immediately was like, she must have been having a bad day, right? Like, it's like part of culture, right? Like, bad day, ice cream, peanut butter, whatever, like overeat, crappy stuff, right? Like, it's just like so accepted, right? You can think of it, a sitcom, you know, any, right? Some character in the show comes home, bad day, ice cream, big spoon, right? It's just like built in.
That's salting the wound.
Yeah, yeah. It's trippy. But the other thing is I've, you know, for years of my career, I've designed nutrition plans for people and helped them. And I had a guy years ago, I remember, and he was struggling with all these things. And so I said, I'm going to make you a plan. And all you have to do is follow the plan, right? I said, I'm going to decide everything and you just do it. So one of the things on the plan was a turkey sandwich, right? You're going to eat a turkey sandwich. So then he comes back and he goes, you know, I tried to make a turkey sandwich. I ate the whole loaf of bread. I was like, he was incapable of not eating an entire loaf of bread so I said, okay, you know what you're going to do? You're going to go to the store and you're going to buy a pre-made turkey sandwich, right? Don't keep any bread in the house, you know what I mean? But it's like, literally, someone can't even stop himself from eating a whole loaf of bread, right? And we run into these things all the time and people act as if it's completely outside of their locus of control, right? They just, I don't want to sound mean, but I mean, I feel like that's about right.
You're not sounding mean at all. I think that there's three elements to it. And I think you hit on the first, and it is that programming that we're programmed by culture, parents, grandparents, aunts, and definitely television and movies. Okay, this is what I'm supposed to do. And so then it becomes culturally acceptable. The second thing is, you know, I don't know that people are necessarily choosing the pain, but I think they're just choosing comfort. And what's comfortable is what's familiar. And so, you know, I can say I sat in that seat for a long time where it was comfortable and familiar that every time I had a bad day, it was Breyers mint chocolate chip ice cream. You know, and in that moment, it felt a little bit better, but then you felt 10 times worse, you know, just after it. And so it is that learning. And that's why I think the third piece is people don't know enough, you know, and I don't want to say that ignorance is the reason, because there is enough information out there to tell us that sugar in excess is bad for us. Alcohol in excess is bad for us. But I still think that people maybe just aren't as educated on the negative impacts of sugar. And so I hope that our listeners really, and yours too, appreciate this conversation, because if we knew what it was doing for us, that for me was the biggest, you know, change maker, is understanding like, oh my gosh, it's drying out my skin. It's giving me more wrinkles. It's, you know, compromising my immune system, my body's ability to recover from a workout, more inflammation. Oh my gosh, you know, like I got to rethink this. And it helped me to make those hard decisions, even though it didn't happen all at once.
People don't understand that. And, you know, like, it sounds like, you know, almost like a conspiracy theory, right? Big sugar is like big tobacco, right? And they've had people on their payroll for decades, basically doctors or whatever, writing, you know, and here's a great example. And this is something that most people have no idea. So you pick up a food, any food, just think of something and you look at that food label, right? Most people, number one, don't look at food labels. But if you've ever looked at a label, it'll tell you, you know, protein, this much, right? Carbohydrates, this much. And it'll usually give a percentage, you know, right? And that percentage is based on this quote unquote theoretical, you know, 2000 calorie a day diet, blah, 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 right? But if you notice this, you look at a label, there's never a percentage next to sugar. Then that percentage is blank. And why is it blank? Because the sugar people have lobbied to keep that information off the labels, because they don't want you to pick up a can of Coke and see, whoa, this is 150 times my daily amount of sugar in this one can, right? They've lobbied to leave that information blank, and it is. And so people pick it up. They have no idea. You get an Arizona iced tea and it says there's 20 grams of sugar in there, but there's actually 4 servings in that can. So, right, you're at 80 grams of sugar, every gram, right? Every teaspoon is, you know, 5 grams of sugar is a teaspoon of sugar, right? So you're looking at a lot of teaspoons in that can. Nobody drinks 1/4 of a can when they open it up, right? And again, that's just one part of what's happening. There's a lot going on in this sugar thing for like big tobacco, right? Deny, deny, deny for decades. Big sugar's doing the same thing. They've been doing it for years and they're still getting away with it, right? There's way more going on, and you know, the earth isn't flat, but there is other things going on.
Yeah, we had the girls from Discover Ag podcast on, Tara and Natalie, and they brought something to our attention that we didn't know. And it speaks into the whole issues around lobbying and marketing, especially. And that is that the agricultural industry as a whole, so you're talking about dairy, cattle, chicken, like anything that falls into that ag category, collectively, they can only, because of restrictions placed upon them, they can only spend up to $750 million a year on marketing their products, right? So these are commoditized products that we know are the healthiest foods to eat. So it's everything on the outside of your supermarket. But everything that's marketed that falls onto the inside of it, just one company alone, like Pepsi, can spend and does spend $2 billion a year on marketing. So why is it so difficult for people to get an education? Because we said moments ago, like people just don't know, right? They just don't know. Why don't they know? And it really does go deep into all of the corruption and all of the rules for one group, no rules for the other, or this, you know, degree of flexibility. And now you have those who are pushing these products that are highly addictive, harmful to our health, if eaten in mass quantities, right? Because I'm not going to use scare tactics here. No food in and of itself is going to be bad for you or create a problem unless you're doing it in excess. But the fact that you can market that food so that people are more drawn to it and do eat it in excess, and now it becomes a problem and it's destroying their health. I mean, that ties exactly into what you were just speaking about.
Yeah. And, you know, flashing back, this is kind of a rolling back for a moment, but about Jesse, you know, like his performance and his nutrition, you know, and the idea of needing carbs or not, right? I tell people, you know, protein is like time release glucose, right? Like our body can manufacture sugar if it thinks it needs it. It's an incredible machine, right? It can turn protein into sugar. It can turn fat into sugar, but it cannot turn fat or sugar into protein. Protein must come from an exogenous source, right? It is the most important. That's why it has pro in the word, right? Check the Greek root of the word. It means first importance, right? Protein. It's number one. And there's a reason why we preach it, but it's also the truth, right? The Greeks already knew it, right? You know, they gave it that name a long time ago. Okay, so they already figured it out.
I think it's important that we be responsible with our language around when we talk about something like sugar, because I agree. Like, and my personal story is, as I was telling a client the other night who wants to lose 100 pounds, I said, you know, I've never been obese. I've never needed to lose 100 pounds of body fat, but I have felt uncomfortable in my body because when I was in middle school, I had eczema so bad, I looked like I had permanent poison oak on my arms. And I was so embarrassed for my classmates to see that I wore long sleeves every single day for 3 years in middle school and into high school, right? It didn't matter if it was 100 degrees out, I was wearing long sleeves. I was so embarrassed. I didn't want to have to deal with people asking me about it. And it wasn't really until I improved my nutrition that those things improved for me. So for me, that was limiting gluten and limiting sugar specifically. And my dental health improved, my skin health improved, my digestive health improved, all kinds of things, right? So for me, that made a big difference. I think we need to be careful around, you know, there are buzzwords that people like to throw around in the, you know, fitness industry, like even medical doctors will use them, like poisons or toxins. I think we need to be careful of those because poisons and toxins, they will kill you instantly, even in very small doses, right? And that's the tricky thing about sugar is that it might not kill you, right? But it is slowly going to unravel your health. So I think we're all on the same page about that. You know, there's another guy who's really interesting out there. He's a psychiatrist, Dr. Chris Palmer, and he wrote a book called Brain Energy. And he has a fascinating theory that, you know, essentially, if you lined up, you know, 100 different people and gave them the same nutrition, you know, they would each have that nutrition expressed. So let's say we overfed 100 different people with sugar. That overfeeding with sugar might express itself in different ways, right? So one person might become obese. One person might develop dementia, right? And it sort of expresses itself or could express itself in different ways. And so that's the really tricky thing around this stuff is like, we can't say for certain because our genetics are expressed differently how, you know, taking in too much sugar is going to affect me or it's going to affect Liam. Like for me, my skin gets bad, right? For somebody else, they get fatter. For another person, you know, their cognitive ability declines. But I think also what we can all agree on is that, you know, we should eat a high protein diet, watch the junk food, and do your strength training consistently. That's how you live a long, healthy life.
Love that you said that. You know, I have a lot of mom friends, and the most interesting thing to me is seeing people that have one kid that's heavier and one kid that's very slim. Yep. And she's so concerned about feeding sugar to the heavy one. And I'm like, you should be so concerned feeding excess sugar to both of them because of the way it expresses itself. Even though the thin kid is not getting heavy, there are so many other internal factors and things that go on there. So I appreciate you just saying that. And I wish more people could just grab a hold of what you said.
Well, and
send them the book.
Yeah, I mean, humans are expressed on this huge continuum, right? And that's every single possible thing that you can imagine is expressed on that continuum, right? Whether it's height or intelligence or, you know, bone structures and skin color and eye color and everything. Like, it's all on there, right? And it's a giant, and there's every possible variation. And many that you have never even thought of are on that continuum, right? But it's the same thing with strength training. We talk, you know, I tell people all the time, if we take 100 people and put them on the exact same workout, we're going to get 100 different outcomes, right? I am willing to bet all of them will get stronger, right? But some will look very muscular, as we know. Some will not. Some will look hardly different at all. It's going to express itself based on that continuum, right? It's whether it's 100 women, 100 men, it doesn't matter, right? A random pick. The workout will deliver the result, but the result will manifest differently across that continuum. But there will always be a positive outcome in a certain extent, but it may not be the outcome that they wish for, right? Based on all those other elements.
I'm glad you said that, just because we had, you know, asked you early on about should training be different for somebody who's 55 plus, which you're in that category, but you were also training throughout your 20s and your 30s. And does exercise really need to be that different for either of those different age groups? And, you know, you said that it's false, that they shouldn't train differently. And we would agree with you. But I think that what you just mentioned is the reason why, is that regardless of the exercise program that's being employed, you know, there's no magic program, there's no magic bullet. And we just know that some people are going to be hyper responders when it comes to resistance training. Some are going to be hypo responders when it comes to, but everybody does respond, period, end of story, which should be very encouraging to anyone out there that we've already talked about the fact that you could train 3 times a week for just 3 weeks out of the month and see significant improvements, or you can train as little as once a week for 12 to 15 minutes, like Jesse's doing right now, and still compete at a very high level. The fact of the matter is that we need to first just be resistance training. That's number one. And then number two, it does need to be employed in a way that is going to be intense enough to deliver the proper response. The fact is that exercise, for all that we like to put it on a pedestal for, it's just a stimulus, people. That's all it is. It is literally providing a stimulus that's telling your body, adapt. Please, yeah, make a change, and preferably a change where I'm building more muscle or getting stronger or improving my conditioning. And then just to circle back to about hormones, I mean, with every muscle contraction, we're releasing myokines and the effect that it's having on our mental health, as well as the health of our organs. So there is like a billion different ways that we could go with this. But I think the general point at the end of the day is, it's like, train hard at any age. Right. And the earlier you start, the better. But we are now seeing tons of research that even people 85 plus are making improvements in their strength. I don't know if you guys, did you guys see that recent study?
We have a guy right now who joined us at 89 years old, never worked out in his entire life. He's a brain guy, right? He spent his entire life working as a teacher in college. He's a virologist. He's like a high level guy. He's got a book that's coming out in his like 18th installment or something. He just retired in the last year or so.
Turned 90.
He's now 90. He's our oldest client at 90. He had never worked out in his entire life. It's taken a little coaxing along the way to get him to learn to work hard. He was a little scared, a little resistant, but he has now learned, you know, to take it to what his edge at the moment, right? And he's learning to push past it and try to work a little harder and all that kind of stuff. And he is getting stronger. And, you know, it's amazing. And he comes in, he dances around in between sets, and he's very smart. He's a sharp guy. He's entertaining. And, you know, he clearly sees the benefit. He's just training with us once a week for 30 minutes. But, you know, he's stuck with it.
Yeah. To your point, Mike, long story short, we train our teenagers the same way we train our 90-year-old. Everybody is training briefly and intensely relative to their current abilities and safely, of course. So that's all moving. Everybody's moving slow and they're training to momentary muscular failure. We don't give people a break because they're 85 years old. They have to work. It's more important that we also push protein on them even more because we've learned from Dr. Sero Oikawa and Dr. Wayne Westcott and Dr. Stu Phillips and everybody's talking about the importance of protein nowadays. You need more of it the older you get. So we just tell people you can't get enough. Just shovel it in there.
Absolutely. Now, hold on real quick, though, regarding momentary muscular failure, I just want to go there for a second. How are you guys defining it for your clients? Because, you know, some people hear that term momentary muscular failure. We use it ourselves. And automatically there's that fear that, oh, my gosh, this means I'm going to have to lift super heavy. I'm going to probably hurt myself. I mean, what do you guys use to determine whether somebody's reached momentary muscular failure?
They have to crawl out of the gym at the end of the workout.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, right? It's going to express itself on that continuum, right? How many people really ever learn to go to true muscular failure? To me, it's not that many, right? So our goal or my job is to get that person as close as I can to putting in a maximal effort on those movements each time and hopefully to help them learn to push against those edges as they continue to move through the process, right? So for me, I start with what I call volitional fatigue, right? I let them sort of give up wherever they want to in the very beginning. And I, you know, as you guys, you know, become experts, you get really good at recognizing, was that really the edge or not? And as that person spends more and more time with you, you learn about them quickly. I'm super good at figuring out, you know, how much and how, and people always go, how did you know that I was reaching failure right then? Or, you know what I mean? Right. And you're like, I've been doing this a while. It's going to express itself very differently. Jesse's like someone he's like a, you know, he can really dig, right? And you think he's done and he finds another one, right? And other people, you know, they're giving up way before, right? So the goal for each of us is to get them to continue to get as close to that edge as possible for the person in front of you. So I don't know if that's a real answer, you know, because there's no set way to know for a fact, right, that they didn't have another rep in there.
Yeah, it's that tension that kind of drives you too, right? You're always like, you know, you try like your life depends on it to finish that last repetition and you don't. And so that's failure. And you should always have that question in your mind, like, maybe I could have gotten another one. And that's what drives you to work a little bit harder the next time.
So, yeah, I'm trying to find for each individual that's in front of me, because they're all different, how to help them reach that place where they learn to give up, to not give up, right? Like I talk about the angel and the devil on your shoulder, right? And, you know, the devil's like saying, I think it's time to put it down, right? And the angel's like, get a couple more, right? And so I want them to ignore the devil, right? And because, so in my mind, for myself, I used to give up, right? Oh my God, it's getting hard. You know, get this thing off of me, right? Like when I first started, right? It's scary, right? We all know that there's a fight or flight thing happening too, right? In these people. So for me now, I've learned when that feeling shows up, because it does show up for all of us, that's my signal that the real work is just starting, right? And now I've learned, not only do I keep going, but I don't stop until the bar or whatever stops moving. And I still push for another 5 or 10 seconds after it's completely stopped moving. I don't stop until that point. I don't just, you know, I don't stop at some random number. It was kind of sort of hard, right? It literally has to not be moving anymore. But not everybody will get there immediately, right? You got to ease them to that place and get them as close as you can, and hopefully keep teaching them to push against that edge, right? There's no magic number of time or seconds or weight. Could they lift lighter and get there? Yes, but it becomes inefficient. Could they get heavier and get there quicker? Yes, but then it becomes more dangerous, right? So we want to find that sweet spot, but it's going to be different. Some people will just thrive at a little longer durations, right? And they just feel better there. Some people like the shorter ones, right? I believe there's a sweet spot for every single person, every single muscle group. It's not the same. Again, part of that continuum. And then you also have the emotional, mental people, right? We have certain people, and you guys may have found this, that just cannot work with an open-ended goal, right? Like, how many should I do? As many as you can, right? That isn't going to work. So with those people, I either learning about them, let's say I'm working with you, Corey Beth, and I know, you know, 100 pounds, I expect you to get 8 to 10 reps, right? Because I know your body really well. And I'll say, I want you to do 20.
Which exercise?
It doesn't matter, right? And that way you're thinking 20, right? You're thinking 20 is my goal. And I know you're never going to get it, right? But now you have a number that you're shooting for. You it's not like just keep going, right? Because some people just can't handle that. Other people, I will ease them into it by doing sub-maximal sets purposely. Let's say I know your 100 pounds is going to get you, again, 8 to 12 reps on a pull down. I'm just making this stuff up. And so I'll say, okay, I want you to do 5, right? And stop. And then I'll let you kind of regroup. Do 5 more, right? And stop. And it makes them happy, right? And I go, now I want you to do 5 plus, meaning do 5 and then see how many more you can do after 5. And I don't care what that number is, right? But that gives them this feeling like I accomplished something, right? I did those 2 sets of 5 and I'm feeling good about it. And now I got another set of 5 because I know they're going to get 5, right? And then I want them to go for the plus. And I don't care what that is. I got 6. I got 7. I got 8. I almost got 9. Awesome. Good job, right?
So mentally feels like a bonus.
Yeah.
It's like extra credit rather than like I'm a failure.
Yeah, right. Because some of them, they just can't. If you just go, hey, do as many as you can, they give up real quick, right? It gets kind of hard. Panic mode and it's done, right? And then they put it down and they go, crap, I'm sure I could have done a bunch more. And I go, well, you know, so it's just ways I tweak it, right? And it's buried on the person in front of me. But I'm still always, I'm trying to get them to work to failure, but I got to change the terminology. I got to change how it looks or how it, right? Still trying to get them there.
It's beautiful. That's the benefit of a coach, you know, to go in and doing that by yourself. You'll never be able to do that. And that's why I think it's so powerful to have a partner, a buddy, somebody that you do work out with. Let's dive into our final question that we did not yet hit. And that is meat. How much meat should a person eat?
Well, the first thing to say about meat is it's what's for dinner.
That's right. Always. And lunch.
But for me, I would say there are like certain outliers. Like if you have a, you know, rare like kidney disorder and you need to eat a low protein diet, those are the extremely rare circumstances where you might not want to eat high protein. But outside of those outliers, eat as much as you can. It's good for you. It's the most bioavailable source of amino acids that you can get, particularly beef, particularly organ meat, if you can stomach it, which I don't like the taste, really. I like heart better than I like liver, but I just eat regular beef, chicken, fish. And, you know, if in terms of body composition, there are some realities you have to acknowledge, which are that, you know, when you eat certain types of meat, they're going to be higher fat, and fat has twice as many calories as carbohydrates or protein. So you might want to change the type of cut you're getting of cow or whatever it might be. Maybe eat more chicken breast instead of chicken thigh or that sort of thing, because you're trying to keep your calories in a particular range. But outside of those considerations, I have no limit on the amount of meat I eat.
Are you guys, since you're on the East Coast, are you familiar with this that tick-borne illness that causes you to be allergic to meat?
We recently heard about it. It's the, was it the Texas?
Long something.
Yeah, I actually have two friends that both have contracted that disease from tick bites, and they literally cannot eat red meat anymore. Basically,
what happens?
It does. It almost causes you to have an anaphylactic response. It can manifest really badly. And you know, I don't know what the chemistry is that's going on, but basically it's mammal meat. And ironically, this one buddy of mine, he never liked to eat seafood, and now he only eats fish because he cannot eat red meat anymore. And so he lives on the Long Island Sound. He goes out and fishes and catches his own fish, which is great. He can't eat red meat anymore. Forever. And like, that is terrifying to me, but it's a separate thing. But I just was wondering if you guys had heard about it, because I think it's more on the East Coast at the moment. Hopefully it doesn't work its way out here, but it probably will.
Yeah. I'm just going to throw in here, because you had mentioned it before, Liam, the fact that I don't believe that there really is a limit on how much meat a person can eat, or even protein for that matter. I mean, all the research that's been done is shown that with people who have do not have any pre-existing kidney issues, that upwards of 2 grams of protein per pound of ideal body weight is still safe. Like, there's no issues with the kidney. And in fact, a lot of the research points to protein having a protective effect around our kidneys. And in fact, we have a client who has a, when she started training with us, her concern about the way to go about nutrition and the fact that we were promoting high protein is that she had this genetic kidney disease that her father actually passed away from at a relatively young age. I mean, he was about around 58 or so, and now here she is. She just entered her 50s and had a lot of concern about this. And so we took, you know, I gave her the option, but I said, this is, you know, if it were me, if it were my health, knowing what I know about the research, this is what I would do. And she decided that, you know what, I'm going to give it a try. And because it was working in terms of her fat loss, she was happy but concerned. She just went to see her the kidney specialist just last week. And she's like, he was thrilled because I've dropped 20 pounds. And although he did find some protein in my urine, he was not concerned that it had anything to do with the diet. This was something that was completely unrelated to the nutrition. And even he had told her that none of the research really shows that there are any issues related to high protein intake being an issue with kidney disease. So it was just really interesting, you know, to get that perspective from somebody who is living it and is consuming a much higher, I mean, I'm talking 3 times more protein than she was eating previously.
Well, and I just want to say, this is not medical advice, no. Nor should it be construed as medical advice. This was a client that, I mean, as a woman, right? I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm concerned for her. But when she made that choice, we were really blown away, because that is always like our first inkling is like, oh, this is what doctors are telling us and what science says. But this kind of like carnivore flipped nutrition on its head for me personally. Her story really made me wonder a lot. And I love that you've dug into some of the research, because this is brand new to us to understand what happened for her. And I wonder how many other people it could help, you know?
You know, the thing that I feel, you know, and that I'm from my own exploration of this stuff is that, you know, there's the protein leverage theory, right? You guys are hearing about there's all kinds of things. But the reality is that I think that there are it's going to be mostly beneficial, right, to increase that protein intake. There's almost no downside to it. Assuming a normal, healthy, functioning body. And not to go down a major rabbit hole, you know, which, you know, this, the whole SECO thing. No matter how much people hold on to that concept, it just isn't true, right? That a calorie is a calorie, right? It just does not hold up in the human body for many, many reasons. Like, they're obviously, total calories do have an impact on things that are going on. But there's just too much other stuff happening with hormone responses, with, you know, all kinds of things. And, you know, this is shown when you eat the same amount of calories, but you tip towards protein or you tip towards carbs, there's different outcomes in body composition, all kinds of things. So favoring protein is going to be the winning choice 99% of the time. And again, it's another thing where people struggle. Like, I'm sure you guys hear this, but every single day in our practice, when we make our protein recommendations, no one ever goes, that sounds reasonable. They all go, oh my God, that sounds like way too much. How could I possibly eat, you know, 120 grams of protein or whatever? That sounds like a lot. Or they go, oh, I'm already getting it, right? I know I am. I go, really? Tell me a little bit about what you're eating. And then it's like, there's no protein in there, right? They'll go like, oh, I had an egg.
I have a happy positive. Yeah, one egg is 6 grams of protein.
Yeah, I had an egg. I'm like, good for you.
I have an optimistic story here, because yeah, I agree with that people are often shocked about our recommendations for protein. But we recently brought on a client who's a referral from his wife, who was already a client with us. And he has a family history of osteoporosis, and he has diagnosed osteoporosis, which is significant. He was an athlete. He was like a world class athlete when he was younger. And so, you know, I had him take me through what a normal day of eating was like. And I literally counted up probably about like 30 grams of protein in his diet. And, you know, he's about 150 pound guy. And I told him, I was like, straight up, I'm like, look, man, you need to eat 5 times more protein than you are every single day. Like, and with your osteoporosis diagnosis, you probably need more than that even. And he's also an older man. He's around 70. So I'm like, look, like, seriously, this is like, the stakes are real here. And so, you know, I made a couple other recommendations, like a D3 K2 supplement, which vitamin K2 helps calcium get into the bone. And so I'm optimistic because he's strength training a couple times a week now. He is making a concerted effort to eat significantly more protein every day. He's got this vitamin supplement that hopefully will help increase bone mineral density for him. So yeah, those are the types of people that that make, you know, because we make these recommendations every single day, all day long. And, you know, people, it kind of, it goes in one ear and out the other. But for every person who actually does make the changes that we're recommending, it makes it all worth it, right? Like, that's why we do what we do, is for those people who make the substantial changes in their life, and it does have a major impact on their health. That's why we do this.
Beautiful. Well, with that, we just want to say thank you guys so much for spending your time, for coming on. It's always a pleasure to see you, better in person than, you know, over the internet, but still equally awesome always.
So you guys are so good looking, it's hurting me a little bit.
Well, if you'd get in the frame, maybe we'd see you and you could say the same. There you go.
That being said, guys, tell everybody where they can find you. Tell them about your podcast. If people are in the Bay Area, where they can find your studio.
Yeah, so we are at www.tntstrength.com. We have been putting out a podcast for 6 or 7 years. I don't know how long it's been. We're over 150 episodes. Incredible content. Awesome guests like you guys, among many others. We also have a blog with tons of great info on it, all there on the site. If you're coming to Oakland, Jesse will tell you where to go.
We are in Rockridge in Oakland. The address is 5255 College Avenue. And, you know, we're on Google. We're on Yelp. We recently achieved a milestone of getting over 100 Google reviews for our studio. So we're pretty excited about that. We put a sign in our window that says we're the number one Google ranked personal training studio in Oakland. So we're very excited about that. Come see our poster.
Yeah, over 100 5-star reviews, mind you, every single one.
5-star rating.
Yeah. Love it. I'd expect nothing less from you two. That's right. And that's what also makes you such swell guys.
Well, we are swell.
And swole.
And swole.
When I grow up, I want to look as good as Mike Lepowski.
Me too. All right, guys. Well, that said, thank you so much for being here. And can't wait to talk to you guys soon.
Thank you guys for having us.
Thanks for tuning in. If you're a busy working parent like us, you understand the daily challenges. Our mission is to make exercise and nutrition simple and exciting, helping you and your family thrive even on the busiest days. We've got a fantastic free 5-day online challenge that's tailor-made for super busy people like you.
If you like a high-vibe workout environment with professional coaching, swing by one of our franchise studios for a free intro workout.
Check the show notes for details or head on over to purephysique.com when you have a moment. We know those moments are rare.
Until next time, lift weights, eat meat, and never forget, you were created on purpose for a purpose.
You know New York, you need New York, you know you need unique New York.
Mixed and edited by Desmond McNeese for We Mixed It, LLC. Go to whatsoundsawesome.com.
What's so funny about that, guys?